You're listening to Anita Marks on 98.7 ESPN.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Anita Marks Show on 98.7 ESPN. I'm Ian O'Connor, columnist with the New York Post, sitting in for Anita for the next 4 hours, and we have a jam-packed radio show for you this afternoon. We've got Jeff Van Gundy coming up, Mike Vaccaro, the great columnist of the New York Post, Ken Davidoff, also a great baseball columnist at the Post, and my teammate, and also Buster Olney. On the spin rates and everything else going on in Major League Baseball. Of course, a lot of talk about Jacob DeGrom. We have Joe Wiz, our gambling expert, at 3 o'clock. And let's start with a gamble. And that might be the Mets gamble with the greatest pitcher in the sport. And frankly, I'm 56 years old now. I'm starting to believe that Jacob DeGrom is the best pitcher I've ever seen, at least in this period of time, if we're talking about the last three-plus seasons. And he's approaching that level. I think if he retired tomorrow, and I do have a Hall of Fame vote, I'd probably vote for him already. And it's fascinating when you look at his career totals. The guy has 76 career victories. It feels like he should have 150 at this point, the way he's pitched. But the gamble, of course, I'm referring to would be the Mets now going forward with him, maybe making his next start after the flexor tendonitis and in that elbow. Afterward, of course, he sounded very non-concerned about, at least relatively speaking, the same with Rojas. And so you wonder, going forward with your franchise player and the best pitcher in the sport, how careful do you need to be here before you just trot him out there? Anything you hear when it relates to the elbow and it's your franchise pitcher, your franchise player, you've got to be really careful. And I really felt this way when DeGrom, before he went on the injured list with that right side tightness in the back and so forth, I thought that no matter what that MRI showed, and I wrote this for the Post, that he needed to go on the IL, and he did. And I thought that made sense simply because he's such an asset that you have to protect your greatest asset, and the Mets did do that. I think in this case, the same thing applies, particularly now you're talking about his arm, his elbow. And there can be no messing around with this. And he showed why again last night. 6 innings, only 80 pitches needed, but complete domination again. 10 strikeouts, no walks. He gave up the one cheap hit to Myers, and he felt like he had no-hit perfect game stuff last night. But frankly, every time he pitches, and it's interesting because he doesn't have the no-hitter or the perfect game, but it feels like he's capable of doing that. And it's amazing. The guy is hitting a Ted Williams 400 at the plate, and you looked at that one at bat when he knocked in the two runs, and it's funny because he serves the ball into left field with a short swing, and just he knows what he's doing on the baseball field, whether he's on the mound, at the plate, on the base pass. He's such a great athlete, the way he fields his position, the way he runs, and just hitting there. If more hitters did that, particularly in the era of the shift, they'd be much better off. I've seen him do that more than once, and the guy is a master of his entire baseball craft, not just pitching. Just he knows how to play the game. So right now where the Mets are at 31-24, and you have to give Rojas a lot of credit for that, just based on the injuries with McNeil out and Davis out and Nimmo out and Conforto out, it's a hell of a job so far by Rojas to have the Mets really at this point. It's a fairly weak division, it looks like, so far. They're 4 games now ahead of the Phillies. And Diaz right now is lighting it up. Whoever would have thunk that, right? Just based on what we saw from him in the past here in New York. But to beat the Padres again, now 3-2 against an excellent team. DeGrom being DeGrom, now 76 wins over in his career. Again, I feel like the guy should have 120. And 6-2 this year. The ERA, of course, at lowering it to 0.56, the lowest over 10 games to start in the history of the sport. And again, he's just such a valuable asset. He's really almost the entire team right now that the Mets have to be very careful here going forward. But here is Jacob DeGrom last night at Citi Field on the discomfort he felt on the mound.
It's along the flexor. You know, that's the thing whenever you say elbow, anything, you know, for a pitcher, everybody gets a little, nervous about that. But like I said, I've I do a lot of ligament tests on my own. In doing those, knowing what that feels like, it's a total different spot. So, like I said, I'm not too worried about it. And, you know, hopefully it's something that we can treat and run back out there in 5 days.
He's not too worried about it, but I'm pretty sure every Met fan is worried about it. And obviously, you can't lose DeGrom for any period of time here. That's why I think it might make sense for the Mets to be very careful, extra careful. Miss a start, even if he says he's good to go. It's just you have to wonder if it's worth it putting him back out there just on the regular 4 days of rest. DeGrom, again, on when he started feeling those issues last night on the mound.
You know, I felt it this week in between. You know, I'm not too concerned about it because it didn't get much worse as the game went on. But there in the, what was that, the sixth inning, when I was loosening, when I was trying to loosen up, I could feel it, and it was tightening up a little bit. But, you know, I've had a couple elbow issues before, and I know what that feels like. So my level of concern is not too high. You know, I'm pretty optimistic about it, and I'm pretty sure it's going to be something that we can treat and hopefully not miss any time.
He's had the Tommy John surgery, of course, in his past, his distant past now, but still, he's had elbow issues. Granted, he doesn't feel like this is a significant one, but a guy who felt tightness before this start, then it flares up again on the mound as he's dominating the Padres. It just sounds to me, obviously I'm not a doctor, and I don't even like to play one on TV or on radio, but just applying common sense, they've got to be really careful here. And DeGrom was asked last night about whether or not he feels he needs more tests to be done.
Based on feel, you know, we did all the ligament tests and all that checks out. You know, I know how that feels. I tried to pitch with a partially torn ligament when I first got drafted, and I know how that feels. And this didn't feel anything like that, so I'm pretty optimistic about where we're at.
Well, we'll see how it plays out and what the Mets decide to do here. And as I said earlier, I do think now DeGrom has reached a point where, at least in my lifetime, I've never seen a better pitcher. And I grew up with Tom Seaver, and just thinking in my teens, looking at Ron Guidry and what he did that 1 year with the Yankees, 25-3, then Gooden, of course, what he did with the Mets. And then in this later generation, Pedro Martinez and Clemens and Randy Johnson and Schilling, and I just don't recall a pitcher over 3-4 seasons doing what DeGrom has done, and maybe hasn't been rewarded in the box score, if you will, but the guy has been absolutely incredible. And Diaz last night called him maybe the best player in baseball, and I do think he's going to be right there for the MVP, assuming he stays healthy. And the Mets are going to be a very fascinating team to watch, just given where they are now despite the injuries, as guys start to come back. And the McKinneys of the world have done terrific work for the Mets, sort of replacing these regular players. But they're going to get these bodies back, and the Mets are going to have a chance maybe to open up a comfortable lead in that division, again, assuming that DeGrom stays healthy. It's the Anita Marks Show here on 98.7 ESPN. Ian O'Connor, columnist with the New York Post, here until 4 o'clock. We've got Jeff Van Gundy later. We've got Mike Vaccaro, Buster Olney, Ken Davidoff. So a terrific lineup of heavyweight guests. We're going to get to the Yankees, to Joe Girardi today against the guy who replaced him, Aaron Boone. So that should be fun in Philadelphia. We'll talk about that. We've got Bucks-Nets tomorrow, game 4. And I think that the Nets are fine after losing game 3. I just thought so many things went against them in that game, and it was so hard for Milwaukee to score. And when you have Giannis, can't make a three, he missed 7 of 8, can't make a free throw. And I just think for a great player in the playoffs, what is he now? 4 for 32 in the playoffs from 3-point range. That is such an obstacle for a great player to overcome in the postseason against a really good team in Brooklyn. That if I'm a Nets fan after game 3, I'm not feeling terrible about my chances, and all of a sudden this is a series and there's great urgency. Now, listen, after tomorrow, if Milwaukee wins again, now we have a different conversation. But you look at really the way KD, he got his 30 anyway because he's KD, but he didn't play well. Joe Harris was terrible. It was almost like I cursed him. I wrote an early column about how great he was that day in the post. And he went out and just was awful. He's not going to play that way again. He's had a really good postseason. I think Bruce Brown got carried away there at the end. And you need to get the ball, obviously, to either Kyrie Irving or Kevin Durant. That didn't happen. So I think the Nets are going to be fine, and we'll talk more about that with Jeff Van Gundy. We're also going to get into the Knicks offseason. I think looking at the way Chris Paul is playing right now at age 36, that is a fascinating thing because reportedly, I believe it was Bleacher Report had it, that he's got that $44 million player option in Phoenix, and the Suns obviously now in complete command of that series against the Nuggets. And he's a guy who apparently now is looking to opt out and maybe get a deal in the range of $100 million over 3 years at age 36. So that's going to be an issue. Do you want to make that kind of investment in a guy who's a Hall of Fame point guard? No question about it. He's never played in the NBA Finals, which is really a shame. A guy of that talent. He's had some bad luck at times in the playoffs with injuries. But he looks healthy now, and last night, 27, 8 assists, 6 rebounds in 37 minutes at his age. I wonder if he'll actually want to leave that situation where a really good young coach in Monty Williams, former Knick, you've got a great young guard with you in Devin Booker. By the way, when I saw him at Kentucky, I did not think he was going to be this kind of player. He was a one and done, but I watched him some, covered him some live in the NCAA tournament. I thought he was a good player. I just did not see this coming. But to leave him, to maybe put yourself out on the market and maybe sign with the Knicks, who obviously need a point guard. They need an upgrade, if not a major one, at that position. Where do the Knicks go? Would they try to sign Chris Paul at that age for 3 years? I think they would. And when you look at his connection to Leon Rose, the CAA connection, and I think that would be a possibility, but not a great one, because he'd be leaving a terrific situation in Phoenix. I'm not sure he's ready to do that when you've got a great young guard and maybe a great young coach in Monty Williams, where you can make a lot of hay in the Western Conference with that group. Ayton's also a really good young center. So is it Lonzo Ball? Is he the guy that the Knicks will turn to? He's obviously a lot younger than Chris Paul. He's not the player that Paul is. So it'll be interesting to see some really major decisions. The Knicks have a lot of salary cap space to work with. What they decide to do this offseason, who they go after. And Chris Paul, the way he's playing, wow. I mean, he looks 26 years old out there. So if he does put himself on the marketplace, I think if you're a Knicks fan as well, you might want the Clippers to get swept, possibly ticking off Kawhi Leonard. And it's I think Adrian Wojnarowski has already said publicly that he believes that Kawhi will stay with the Clippers. So I think you might want to take that to the bank. However, you never know, right? And he's a little bit of a fickle guy. So if they get swept, would that maybe convince him to reconsider, put himself out there and maybe consider New York?
You're listening to Anita Marks on 98.7 ESPN.
Tomorrow on MSG Plus, join Butch Goring and Shannon Hogan for live, complete Islanders post-game wrap-up with all the highlights, locker room interviews, and much, much more. Remember to turn to MSG Plus immediately following Islanders Lightning Game 1 for the Islanders post-game show tomorrow on MSG Plus, or stream it on MSG Go. When I think of the Islanders, I think of my old-school days as a kid growing up listening to John Sterling on WMCA. And Islander goal. That was John Sterling's call. I remember, unfortunately, I lost my brother tragically, really, last year at age 57. But we used to go as kids to bed early just to listen to John Sterling call Islanders games in the mid to late 70s in the second and third period at the Nassau Coliseum. So there's a bit of a nostalgia to see the Islanders back with one last chance in the barn to maybe win a Stanley Cup, because that dynasty was my first dynasty as a sports fan. The Islanders, starting in 1980, winning 4 straight cups, had a chance to make it 5. And unless you count the Yankees of 77 and 78 as a dynasty, winning 2 in a row, I was a big Yankee fan. I'm a big Reggie Jackson, Thurman Munson guy. I don't know if that really was a dynasty. They lose in 76 to the Big Red Machine in a sweep, and then they win the next 2 World Series. That's debatable. But the Islanders of 80, for the next 4 seasons into that 5th season, to win 4 straight Stanley Cups. And I was a a huge Mike Bossy fan. I hated Tiger Williams. Look him up. He was an absolute goon. And I mean, he just was a headhunter, and you just did not want to be around him on the ice. And he hunted down Mike Bossy. And Bossy was a guy who just would not fight. He did not believe in it. And so all the enforcers in the league, they knew that. And so he took a beating at times, but what a great player and great scorer and a great memory from my childhood, looking at the Islanders now with a chance to get back at the Lightning after getting bounced by them last year in the conference final, now in the Stanley Cup semis at the Lightning, game one tomorrow. You can listen to that at 3 o'clock right here on 98.7 ESPN. But we're talking about Nets Bucks. We got Van Gundy coming up. And a little bit later on the Knicks offseason, Chris Paul, are you in love with that idea? Do you think the Knicks would do that, particularly at age 36, wants 3 years, reportedly Bleacher Report, $100 million, might reject that, turn down that player option at $44 million. Well, that's a good life, isn't it, to have a chance to turn down $44 million for a better deal? But he deserves it. The guy's one of the best ever to do it. I don't know where you'd put him on the all-time point guard list, but he's pretty high up. Just believe it or not, never played in an NBA Finals, never mind winning a championship. So it's a bit of a shame because he is a tremendous, tremendous floor leader, visionary passer, ball handler, the whole thing. So in a sense, you'd like to see him get a crack at it. 1-800-919-3776. Let's go to the phone lines. We're talking Nets Bucks. I think the Nets are still in complete command of this series. I'm not too concerned about the Game 3 loss, but let's go to JP in Brooklyn. JP, what's your thoughts on the Nets in Game 4?
Hey, thanks a lot. Thanks for having me. I have a question for you. Is there something wrong with DeAndre Jordan?
Is he hurt or something?
If DeAndre Jordan is not hurt.
Yeah, sorry. The phone line there just wasn't, sorry, JP, good enough. But I don't think DeAndre Jordan right now is a huge concern, just given the fact that I think defensively, and that's where he's going to help you a lot with rim protection, the Nets have been really good. And so their strategy in this series and the bigs they're playing and what they're doing to Giannis, he got his numbers in game, what was it, game one. But just what they're doing to him, just dropping off and letting him take that perimeter shot, I think right now has been a great strategy, and he's willing to take it. I mean, at some point, when he's doing that, he is just bailing out the defense. And the Nets are going to be more than happy to let him do that the entire series. And it's a shame that a player that great, with that kind of size and strength and speed and athleticism and length, he's got this Achilles heel, but he's, in a sense, playing right into the Nets' hands by taking that shot. And he just needs to get better from the free throw line. And that little hitch he's got in his delivery and the delay in the routine going over the 10-second legal limit is a problem. And so for that kind of franchise player to carry you through a playoff series, it's not easy because he's got these flaws that a defense can exploit. Now, I am a bit surprised that the Nets defensively have been as good as they have been in this series and in these playoffs, because you know, you saw clearly that that looked like it was going to be a major issue for Steve Nash and company, but it hasn't been. It's in this last game, it was the offense. And I just don't think that Joe Harris is going to play that dreadfully again in this series, or maybe the entire playoffs. It's possible he will. I don't think so. I think Bruce Brown is never going to take two big shots in the final 20 seconds again. I think he learned his lesson there. And he has been really good for them, so I'm not trying to knock him. But that ball needed to get back to either Irving or Durant at the end, and it didn't. Let's go to Emmanuel in Flushing. Emmanuel, what's on your mind?
Hey, Ian, first of all, welcome back to the radio thing, because I used to listen to you on radios on Sunday right before Mike Lupica, because my favorite story was when you brought up, I mentioned like years ago, when you brought up, when you interviewed the late Gary Carcini and got right to saw about that his UNLV team was going to be clobbered by Duke. That was one of my favorite.
Well, no, he didn't say, thank you, Emmanuel. He didn't say clobbered. He just, I flew on the plane with the UNLV team, that great UNLV team in 91.
One.
Right, and they were undefeated, maybe the greatest college basketball team I've ever seen of all time, anyone's seen, And I was sitting with Tark on the plane flying to Indianapolis for the Final Four against Duke, and he just said, we have nobody on this plane to cover Christian Laettner. And guess what? He was right. But anyway, you want to talk about the Nets. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yes. I want to bring up the Nets. I mean, I'm a Knicks fan, but I obviously watch the Nets. But do you think you'd be a little bit concerned in the next series if they face Philly or even Atlanta?
Not Atlanta. I think Atlanta, and thank you for the call, Emmanuel, and thank you for the kind words. I think Atlanta has won its last game in this postseason. That's what I believe. We'll see how it plays out. So I think it's going to be the Sixers. Yeah, I'm concerned, more concerned now that Embiid is playing like he's completely healthy. And I thought that meniscus problem in his knee was going to be a fairly big problem for him or issue, and it hasn't been. The guy looks great. So that is going to be a real challenge for the Nets, assuming the Nets get to that point, and I think they will. But I think Embiid's health has surprised a lot of people, maybe even Embiid himself. But if he's going to play like that, now I think that Simmons is going to have to make some shots to beat the Nets in a 7-game series, and I'm not sure he's ready to do that. I know Doc Rivers pushed him last night. He played better. But what did he take in game, what was it, game two? He took 3 shots? He had 4 points, I think it was. So Simmons is going to have to help to beat Brooklyn. Let's go to Mel in Queens. Mel, you want to talk about Chris Paul? What are your thoughts?
Hey, what's going on? Enjoying the show.
Thanks, man.
I just want to say I feel like Chris Paul is overrated. You know, he's a good player. I'm not saying he's not a good player, but he's not like a great, great player like the Currys, the Magics, the Isaiah Thomases, the Jason Kidds, the Gary Paytons, and those guys. Because Chris Paul, when it's time to come down, he either chokes or he's always injured. You know, and I get tired of hearing this whole narrative that this, he's some winner and all this. He's not a winner. He went to the conference finals one time. Carmelo Anthony is called the loser. He gets so much heat, and he's been to more conference finals than Chris Paul. So I like Chris Paul as a player. I think he's a flawed general. We want to highlight him being a flawed general, yes. But we got to stop over-exaggerating how great he is and all this stuff. He's a good player, but he's not no all-time great top 10 point guard right now, I don't think.
All right, thanks for the call, Mel. I don't really agree with you on that. I think some of it, the injuries, I don't know if you blame a guy for that. And availability is the most important ability, as they say, with athletes, with great athletes. And he has been unavailable at times and sometimes at the biggest moments. But Chris Paul is I think he's a great player. He's not Magic Johnson. I would not put him in that category. But I think to call him one of the great point guards of all time is not pushing it.
You're listening to Anita Marks on 98.7 ESPN.
Ian O'Connor, columnist for the New York Post, in for Anita, 98.7 ESPN. And it's time for the Truly Hard Play of the Game, brought to you by Truly Hard Seltzer. And my play would be simple. DeGrom's 2-run single and going the opposite way last night against Snell. A lefty-on-lefty matchup, and to see DeGrom again as a master of the entire craft, that short swing going the opposite way for a 2-run single to give himself his 6th victory of the season before he's taken out with the flexor tendonitis. But there was so much in that at-bat, the athleticism, the intelligence, using the entire field, a guy now hitting .400 as the best pitcher in baseball. I think that it's really amazing to watch this guy just play the game the right way in every facet of the game. And that's the Truly Hard Play of the Game, brought to you by Truly Hard Seltzer. Try Truly Hard Seltzer, 100 calories, 1 gram sugar, 5% alcohol, and 27 different flavors. Truly Hard Seltzer Beverage Company. Please drink responsibly, as always. Mike Vaccaro of the New York Post coming up at 1:30. We'll have Buster Olney, ESPN's great baseball columnist and analyst, coming up after him. Ken Davidoff, also of the Post, at 2 o'clock. So we've got a jam-packed show, a lot of baseball. Want to still get some basketball in here with the NBA playoffs going on. Of course, Nets Bucks game 4 tomorrow, 3 o'clock, ABC. We've also got the Islanders Lightning game 1. You can listen to that right here on 98.7 at 3 o'clock tomorrow. And the Islanders, of course, trying to avenge their elimination, being bounced from the Stanley Cup tournament last year by the defending champs in Tampa Bay. But one point I want to make, and our phone line's 1-800-919-3776, 1-800-919-3776. If you have thoughts on Bucks Nets, on the Knicks point guard situation, and what you want the Knicks to do this offseason. I also want to get into Kevin Durant's legacy. Now, he got into this Twitter thing with Jay Williams of ESPN. Jay Williams, of course, the former Duke All-American, number one overall pick. And his NBA career really tragically, unfortunately, ended with the motorcycle accident, or else he could have been one of the great point guards maybe ever. And they went back and forth, and it's not worth revisiting that. But KD's always been very sensitive to criticism, and to he gets involved and engages in these back and forths on social media all the time. And it looks unnecessary, but it doesn't affect him on the floor. It sure doesn't appear that way. And that's why I want to talk about his legacy, because I think in that back and forth with Jay Williams, he talked about not caring. He doesn't talk about legacy, doesn't care about legacy. I think all the great ones really do. And so I'm sure in the back of his mind, if not in the front of his mind, legacy is important to him. And he's a guy who's going to go down as one of the all-time greats, I think, without question. The only question is, how great? And if you put together a list of top 20, top 15, top 10 all-time players, where is Kevin Durant going to fall? And frankly, I had a line in a column, that's really all it was recently, where I said there's a chance that Kevin Durant, particularly if he can win this championship, not with the Warriors, and he got a lot of criticism for that, going to a ready-made championship situation, winning two rings, though he was finals MVP both times, took criticism for getting eliminated when he was in Oklahoma City by the Warriors and then going to play with them. He got a break that the Warriors lost the finals that year to Cleveland, so he could sort of sell himself as the final piece for the Warriors to get back to the championship stage. And it did play out that way. And of course, then the following year after winning the two rings, he has the ruptured Achilles and doesn't get the third ring. So now he's in Brooklyn, not the same situation. Yes, he did join up with Kyrie Irving and arrive in Brooklyn as part of a superstar package deal. But at the time, there was no indication they'd ever get a third star like James Harden. That's happened. And now Harden being out, I wonder if it's a greater opportunity, and I've written this as well, for KD to enhance his legacy. If he can win this ring with Harden in and out of the lineup, or maybe just out of the lineup going forward, because you never know with hamstrings, it's going to be fascinating to see what it does for him. I think in a sense that him trying to catch LeBron James, and what do we mean by catch? It's not just championship rings. It's just in the minds, I think, of the basketball public as to where you are on that all-time list. I don't think he's ever going to surpass LeBron James on the all-time great list. It's sort of similar to LeBron trying to catch Michael Jordan. I don't think that's going to happen either. Although LeBron James has a better chance of doing that than I think Durant does of surpassing LeBron. But I think on the list of all-time small forwards, and I did mention this in the column, that Durant is in a position where he could surpass everyone on that small forward list, including Larry Bird, except for LeBron. And I got some angry emails, some old schoolers who, and listen, Larry Bird is you can't question historically anything that he's done or his place in the game's history. But if you look at the numbers, and it's not always about numbers, Larry Bird versus Durant. And there are some things that Durant has on Bird. There are some things that Bird has on Durant. The biggest thing that Bird has on Durant would be the championships 3-2. That could change in the next 5, 6, 7 weeks. He also has the three straight MVPs. Durant was only league MVP once. So that's probably the biggest thing you have going for you if you're a Larry Bird supporter. But Durant, I think, has an opportunity here to really climb the ladder. If he wins one or two with Brooklyn, I would put him ahead of Larry Bird. And it's blasphemy to some people, and I did hear that in my email box rather loudly and clearly, including from the dean of all basketball writers, Bob Ryan, up in Boston. But KD's got some more basketball to play here. He's got potentially some more championships to win. And I think this series, and if the Nets survive it, which I think they will, if they beat Philly, I think Philly's going to win now the next two games and close out that series. And then take out whoever comes out of the West. I think that's going to be a huge thing for Kevin Durant. If you have any thoughts on where you see him among the all-time greats, give us a call. 1-800-919-3776. Let's go back to JP in Brooklyn. JP, your thoughts on the Nets front court. Go ahead.
Thanks for having me. I'm sorry. I was on Bluetooth and I
couldn't hear. No problem. No, go ahead. Don't worry about it.
We're good right now. Check it out. A few things. You said a couple of things that I was like, whoa, wait a minute. KD's going to be better than Jordan. I'm calling it right now. He's going to be better than Jordan. Once the championship, he's going to establish a legacy in Brooklyn. I'm running for city councilman, so I'm going to erect a statue, in his name in Brooklyn. Okay, that's how serious KD is going to be. Now, let's get back to the Nets right now. We're going to have to play DeAndre Jordan. I'm not a fan of the way Blake Griffin has been playing. A five-time All-Star, a former Rookie of the Year, only taking five shots. Bruce Brown took 17 shots.
Well, listen, JP, thanks for the call. I think on the first front there, Kevin Durant's not going to be better than Michael Jordan. That's not going to happen. I took a lot of heat for just suggesting he could surpass Larry Bird's, and never mind Jordan. I think when it comes to what the Nets are doing up front, DeAndre Jordan versus Blake Griffin, it was only 15 minutes ago we were all saying, wow, Blake Griffin looks like he's 25 years old again, flying, dunking on Giannis, and DeAndre Jordan gives you rim protection. I understand that, and he's a very accomplished NBA player. But the Nets defensively, it's hard to question anything they're doing, anything Steve Nash has done so far, because defensively they've been great. So I think right now, if they lose game four and it's 2-2, all of a sudden it becomes a best of three and the Nets are in a little bit of trouble. They're going to have to look at everything they're doing, particularly if Harden isn't coming back. And who knows? I haven't heard if there's been an announcement yet today about his status for game four. I imagine he's not going to play. If I had to guess, I think the Nets are going to try to play it safe with his hamstring. They know how delicate hamstrings are, and only play him when it's a tied series or if they get behind, which I don't think is going to happen. Let's go to Rock in Bed-Stuy. Rock, you have a thought on the Knicks point guard situation. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
You got it.
Okay, my opinion, everybody keeps saying, kind of playing Chris Paul, maybe Damian Lillard coming to the Knicks as a point guard. I got a better one that will save the salary cap and keep most of the team intact and give them room to find another shooter for the second unit. Why not go after Spencer Dinwiddie, who won't be a fit and won't have much playing time in Brooklyn next year when he's healthy? We can put Spencer Dinwiddie at the point. Then we can have Barrett. Then we can have Randall Robinson and Bullock starting.
And Derrick Rose off the bench. Re-sign Derrick Rose.
Yes. You got Rose coming off the bench with Quickley, with Burks, with Toppin, and with Noel or Gibson, depending on the matchup. And that stretches the bench a little bit more. Then we got this kid, Vildoza, who we haven't seen yet, so we can't see what he's going to bring, but they still give us more insurance at the point. Now we got veteran quality point starting, veteran quality point running the second unit, scoring in both units and depth, and still salary cap room to find a big, big man that can stretch the floor or play down low and let Randall stretch the floor.
Well, Rock, I like your thoughts. Thanks for the phone call. And I think that's not that's a viable option, I think, for the Knicks. I'd be curious to see just how interested they are in Lonzo Ball as a restricted free agent. New Orleans could match. There's been reports that they maybe wouldn't match. So that's another possibility. But I like your line of thinking there. Let's go to Sam in Northport. Sam, your thoughts on KD and Larry Bird. Go ahead, Sam.
Hey, how you doing?
Oh, good. Thanks, Sam. Go ahead. What's on your mind?
Good. Okay. I think that if KD wins a chip this year with the Nets, especially like you were saying with Harden in and out of the lineup, I personally think that jumps him above Larry Bird this year, let alone the few more years at least that he has to prove himself even more. So that's first of all. And also, I just wanted to talk quick about the Nets game. Bruce Brown, I get he's played well this year for them, why is he taking all the shots in the last 2 minutes of the game? And you look over on the Bucks side, and Giannis and Middleton are taking all their shots. That's what cost them the game. I just thought that was terrible coaching.
Thanks for the call, Sam. I'd take it a little easy on Bruce Brown. He made a mistake down the stretch and maybe thought he was Kyrie Irving there for a second. Nobody complained, by the way, when Bruce Brown had 10 points and 5 rebounds in the second quarter. He's been really good for them. He just got carried away. It's okay. He's a young guy, former G-leaguer, trying to find his way in the league. He's done a terrific job for the Brooklyn Nets, and that's what I thought that was. And the Nets are, they're learning too as they go along here. They haven't spent a whole lot of time together. Steve Nash has said that. We need to go through some adversity, and boy, did they get some at the end of that game that looked like a complete mess, but that entire game was a complete mess. So I'm going to try to cut him a little bit of slack there. Bruce Brown, just in that situation, maybe panicked a little bit. And maybe he was feeling himself a little bit because he's done some great things for the Nets to date.
You're listening to Anita Marks on 98.7 ESPN.
Mets right now in first place, 4 games ahead of the Phillies, who play the Yankees today. An interesting matchup between the last 2 Yankee managers, including the current one, Aaron Boone, against the man who replaced Joe Girardi. The Yankees need to get going in a hurry. I'm still confident the Yankees are going to make the playoffs. I just think that's what they do. I don't think they're going to win the division, and I don't think they're going to win the World Series, but I think Boone is going to get the rest of the season, and he deserves as much after what he did those first 2 years. It's just too soon to talk about changing managers, and really, Hal Steinbrenner, that's not his style. It's not Cashman's style, and so I think any discussion about Boone being in jeopardy, I think, is really premature at this point. I think he gets the full season. Then let's see where they are. Outside of them completely falling apart, that's not going to happen. Anyway, 1-800-919-3776. Let's go to Marty in Queens. Marty, your thoughts on Mr. DeGrom. Go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can hear you, Marty. Go ahead.
Great. Hi, I'm a Yankee fan, but I watched the game last night, the Met game last night. Yankees weren't on. And I've heard about DeGrom here and there, and I've seen him pitch occasionally over the years. He is absolutely masterful. I cannot believe how good he is. Wish I had him. But point of it is him coming back to pitch on Wednesday with inflammation of the elbow, something very strange about that. Tommy John surgery. He had it when he was a kid about 10 or 12 years ago, and he's recovered from it better than any pitcher I've seen. And he's the best pitcher in baseball.
Well, you know what's amazing, Marty, about DeGrom is here's a guy who, when he was a shortstop in college at Stetson, he did not want to pitch. He almost had to be forced to the mound. And he is, as I said earlier, right now, he's gotten to be, I think, the best pitcher I've ever seen.
Best pitcher I've ever seen. I saw Koufax. I'm that old. I saw Koufax in person. At any rate, the next thing is, as far as Boone goes, and I am a Yankee fan the last 25, 30 years, really not my cup of tea. He takes orders from upstairs. He takes orders from the people who promote the statistical side of baseball, and he's done some very strange things. He's done some very strange things about resting his players, which just galls me. I mean, these are prime athletes in the mid-20s, late 20s, and he rests them periodically, unnaturally. And I don't like what he's done with the Yankees. He won 100 games, then he won 103 games. Now he's got Gerrit Cole, and frankly speaking, he's a little too cautious. He's a little too Yankee boy for me. I want a guy. I mean, Ken Davidoff came on and really spilled it. I mean, he said, he doesn't think that the Aaron Boone is the manager he should be. And, I mean, I think that's great. And Girardi would be a much better choice.
Marty, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Girardi did wear out his welcome at the end there, as Ken alluded to. It was hard to be around him. It was a perfect way of putting it the way Ken did. He just was not user-friendly, not even close to that anymore. And he just wore out his welcome. And, I mean, how many times do you fire a manager after getting within one game of the World Series, and he had already won a World Series? Granted, it was years ago, but he did and was regularly in the playoffs. What, Girardi made the playoffs 6 times, was it? And maybe you would have wanted 7 or 8 appearances instead of 6, but he won you a championship. He got you back to the brink of the World Series, and he gets fired. The reason it was all human relations. I'll never forget being out at Yankee Stadium getting ready to write a column about how if Girardi can win a second ring, maybe he could get to a point where if he's not beloved, the fans could embrace him as a multiple champion, as a guy who led the Yankees back after winning in 09 and was told by people I talked to that it might not be a good idea to write that column. Why? Because they already thought that they might fire Girardi, that the only thing I think was going to save him was winning the whole thing. So, listen, I'm sure every time he faces the Yankees now, like he will today in a little bit at, 4:05 in Philadelphia, he's facing the guy who replaced him. So he's going to be pretty fired up for that. Girardi's got his own problems with Philadelphia. They're now 4 games behind the Mets. But Aaron Boone was hired for his human relations skills. Obviously, he comes from a very good baseball family, really experienced baseball guy, was a good broadcaster for ESPN. And so they bring him in because he was the anti-Girardi, and the idea was he was going to connect with the young players on a much better level than Girardi did. He was going to be better with the media, he'd handle questions about injury, certainly a lot better than Girardi handled the Bryce Harper situation a couple weeks ago in Philadelphia. He created a bit of a firestorm by admitting that he lied about Harper and will lie going forward to protect against opponents having a competitive advantage. This isn't football. In baseball, you try to avoid contact, and in football, you seek contact. And I think that baseball managers shouldn't be as concerned about that sort of thing like football head coaches are. And also, by the way, Bryce Harper, that first game where Girardi lied about his status, was sitting in the dugout not wearing his uniform top. So I think the opposing manager Don Mattingly? I think it might have been. I think figured out that he wasn't going to play in that game. So Girardi sometimes will commit unforced errors. Is he a superior tactician to Boone? Probably. But he's just a guy that is hard to embrace. And he was told after year one in New York, after 2008, which was not a good season for him following Joe Torre, tough act to follow, to make changes, the kind of changes Tom Coughlin made with the Giants. And he listened and he did it. And guess what? The Yankees won the World Series. And then guess what? He regressed over time back to the way he used to be.
You're listening to Anita Marks on 98.7 ESPN.
And Joe Wiz on 98.7 ESPN is brought to you by PlaySugarHouse.com and by Infinity of my hometown, Englewood, New Jersey. And Joe, it's Ian O'Connor. Now, you're talking to somebody who is an amateur hour bettor who might put down $2 on a horse to show at the racetrack or bet $20 in an NCAA tournament pool. That's about it. But maybe you can educate me here and give me a couple of your chosen plays today.
Well, Ian, you hit the nail right on the head. You got to bet small to win big. You know, these people out there betting big money, not the right move. I always tell people to bet smart and go into the racetrack or whether you're betting anywhere. The most important thing is to bet smart and to always go in with a conservative game plan because it's very, very tricky out there and you have to know what's going on. So I like your strategy. I go to the track and I'll bet dollar exacta boxes for $6 and I'll swing for the fences and sometimes I hit thousands of dollars.
Can I give you a couple of NBA games for your take on it, or do you have something that you want to?
Whatever you want, whatever you got to ask me, I'm ready to roll.
Let's talk about the Clippers. I like the Clippers tonight. I think they're giving 4. I just don't like them going down 3-0 in that series against Utah. What's your opinion on that?
Well, Ian, you take a look at it. The Clippers right now, the line is at 4.5, and the totals are 223. And, you know, you got to be careful because same thing happened last night. Everyone's like, oh, Denver has to win. Just because the team has to win doesn't mean they're going to. But in this scenario here, the total of this game is at 223. Sometimes I may not look at the game. I may look at the total here. 6 of the last 8 meetings between the Jazz and Clippers have gone under the total. And I know in game 2, the Jazz won that game 117-111. That game did go over. But I think that the Clippers need to play some defense here, and that's going to be the deciding factor in this game here. Donovan Mitchell has been lights out, you know, 45 points in game 1, 37 in game 2. I don't think Mitchell's going to have a great game like that. I think the Clippers and Ty Lue are going to come up with a game plan to shut Donovan down and let someone else beat them. The total's 223. Ian, I like to totally go under in this total. Clippers will win, but this line is a little tricky here. I'm not interested in laying the 5. I'd rather play the total under.
All right, Joe, give me your feeling on Game 4 Nets-Bucks tomorrow.
boy, when you take a look at this game here, I mean, the Bucks have just been such a big disappointment in the playoffs after taking a sweep in the Miami Heat. Game one, they scored 107 points, and game three, just 86 points here. It's hard not to like Brooklyn in this game here. They're laying two in this game here. I think if Brooklyn comes to play, which I think they will, you know, Brooklyn had, 83 points? That was the lowest output of the season, Ian. I think that the Brooklyn Nets are going to fire on all cylinders here and take command of this series. Lights out for the Bucks.
Now, I haven't looked at the spread the next Suns game against the Nuggets, but I'm thinking that you've got the Suns winning and covering.
Well, no, I don't. Phoenix is laying three in this game. That's the line. It's the updated line. Phoenix is minus three, and a total to 222. I'm going to take a shot and play the home dog in this game here. Denver has to come out. Obviously, the matchup doesn't favor the Denver Nuggets. Jokic just can only do so much. I think that Denver's going to win one of these games. I think that I'm going with Phoenix in this. I'm going with Denver plus the three. I'm taking the home dog. Not only am I taking them plus the three, I'm taking them on the money line plus 140. So those of you out there listening, if you take Denver on the money line, if you put up 100, you'll get back 140, so you'll make a little bit more money. Denver will get the win against Phoenix in game four.
All right, final thing. Now, I'm a golf guy. I don't want to throw you off here the first time we're talking, Joe, but the United States Open being played next week at Torrey Pines, and I think the sentimental story would be Phil Mickelson winning, but do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I don't know if Phil Mickelson's going to win another championship. I mean, he did a phenomenal job in the PGA. Ian, when it comes to golf, and I know you're an avid golfer, I'm swinging for the fences. We all know the typical names, Rahm and Koepka and Spieth and DJ. They're all favorites, and you're getting some value. But I was talking to Ty before we went on the air here, and I gave him some long shots here. Ian Poulter, 200-1. And you got Max Homer at 100-1 and Keegan Bradley at 100-1. I know they're long shots, but, you know, I'll throw in some of the smaller price ones that I mentioned with Rahm and Koepka. But, you know, with golf, like it says, you can put down a small amount of money, even if you're betting, Bradley at 100-1. It's a pretty good payoff for a small investment. That's what I like with golf. You can make a big return on investment with a small investment.
All right. Well, I learned something here, which is always a good thing. Thanks very much, Joe, and look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you very much, Ian. Great show.
All right. That's Joe Wiz, brought to you by PlaySugarHouse.com. Redeem your free pro football profit boost every week. Simply log in and receive a 50% profit boost to use on any pro football game. This offer is open to current and new PlaySugarHouse.com bettors. Visit PlaySugarHouse.com for full details. Must be located in New Jersey and 21 and over. Gambling problem, call 1-800-GAMBLER. That's 1-800-GAMBLER. And by Infinity of Englewood in New Jersey, they pride themselves on serving every customer with courtesy. When they're shopping for a new or used Infinity car or SUV, call 201-500-1754. That's 201-500-1754. Visit infinityofenglewood.com. So, yeah, I learned something there, and again, I'm not a big gambler or better on much of anything, but why not? A few bucks here and there never hurt anyone. Ian O'Connor in for Anita Marks, 98.7 ESPN. I think that I can't go 4 hours here. I haven't done this in a long time, so this has been a lot of fun to get back in the saddle on this, the greatest radio station in the greatest city in the world, frankly. And used to have a Sunday morning show every week, and that was very enjoyable. And also educational to me as a guy who spent most of his career as a columnist in this town and in a couple of other places. But I can't go 4 hours without talking about what happened yesterday in France. And by the way, I should say that the Danish star, Christian Eriksen, who collapsed during the Denmark-Finland game in Euro 2020, has been taken to the hospital, and that game has resumed on ESPN. Finland up 1-0, but it was a horrible scene. Let's send out prayers to Christian Eriksen and his family and hope he's going to be okay. That game has resumed. But speaking of overseas tournaments, what happened in France yesterday between Djokovic and Rafa Nadal, and it's kind of a shame in this country that tennis has fallen off the way that it has. There was a period when I was growing up where there was this tennis boom in the 70s. You could not get on a tennis court in this country. You could not. You had to wait. you could be online. There were limits to how long you could play on a public court, maybe an hour. There'd be three or four people waiting for the next 3 or 4 hour slots. It was crazy, and then it just disappeared. Now, that was back in the Connors, McEnroe, Borg, and then some Lendl in there, those days. And what's amazing is this era of tennis, and unfortunately for this country, it doesn't involve any American men. So I think that's part of it. We had Serena Williams as the greatest female player of all time, but she's now at the tail end of her career trying to break that record of Margaret Court's. She obviously is a much better player than Margaret Court ever was. I don't think she has to break that record, but you want her because she deserves it. She is the greatest, and you want to see her get that historical achievement, and I think she will. It's just in the last couple of years, it's been very difficult for her, but I think she'll get over that hump. I do, and I do want to see that happen. But on the men's side, they're just you don't have those great players anymore. Our country's just not producing them. But what we're seeing today, don't forget, with Roger Federer, Djokovic, and Nadal, it would be like, if you're a golf fan, Tiger Woods, Jack Nicklaus, and Ben Hogan in their primes at the same time. Just think of how that would play out in this country and how big golf would be if that was going on right now. These three great champions, I mean, I thought at one point that Pete Sampras at 14 majors, that record wasn't going to get broken. Now, these three guys have blown past that number. You've got 20 for Nadal, 20 for Federer, and 18 and counting if Djokovic finishes it off like he's favored to do tomorrow in the French Open final. But I've never seen, usually when you talk about a classic tennis match, you're talking about five setters. That was not a five setter yesterday. It was a four setter. And the fourth set finished, what was it, 6-2? But it was still a classic if you watched it and you understood the unbeatable, indomitable force that Nadal has been in Paris. To have won that tournament 13 times, and I think his record there was 104, 105-2 going into that match yesterday. Djokovic has had his number a little bit, and the GOAT conversation is complicated in tennis. Some people count 13 majors for Nadal at the French against him and use that to explain how he's not the greatest of all time because he's dominated that one surface. Yet, I say, well, if Federer's had the most success on grass at Wimbledon, why does that not count against him? So it gets complicated. Djokovic may end up with the most majors of anyone, and he's got a winning record against both of those guys. So I didn't think it was right to go 4 hours here without talking about what was an amazing day yesterday in men's tennis. It is a little unfortunate that we don't have at least one American in there to create more interest in this country, at least on the men's side of the sport. But we'll see. Maybe one day we'll get another Sampras, another McEnroe. You know, it's funny. John McEnroe is considered an all-time great. Seven majors. These guys are going to triple that number, probably all three of them before they're done. So that just shows the greatness of this generation. And again, in a golf context, it's like Tiger Woods, Jack Nicklaus, and Ben Hogan all playing in their primes at the top of their games. Now, Federer and Nadal even are getting a little older, but still very much at the top of their games, and it is a bit of a shame in this country. It doesn't get more recognition. It doesn't get, recognized for what it really is, an amazing thing to witness. Ian O'Connor in for the great Anita Marks, 98.7 ESPN. Let's go to the phone lines, 1-800-919-3776. Let's go to Artie in Brooklyn. Artie, you have a thought on Luis Rojas. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking the call. I appreciate it.
You got it, Artie.
I went to the game yesterday, and I never thought that Rojas should have got the job based on the experience. I wanted Drumartie in here, and then now to make the argument that I still want Drumartie, I still want Drumartie because I figured I want a more experienced guy, a guy that's done it. Look, they play for him. I can't argue, and I can't argue with results to say that he's not done a good job. But the stuff that he does managerial-wise, game-wise, just kills me. And the stuff to the consistency or inconsistency. He'll put Familia in there three games in a row, right? And then you won't see Familia. Yesterday, all right, fine. We had no idea that what's his name was hurt. But he goes to Castro. Fine, he didn't have it. The next guy up is Loop, who faces righties. And then he brings in Diaz. Now, I don't know if he doesn't remember, but he bought in Diaz last year, and then they bring up a stack. Cohen goes, this is the first time in five. Rubio. He didn't bring in May. Then batting third, he has McCann. Now, I understand. How many guys does he have? But that's your third place hitter? You got McCann, but he's just driving me absolutely nuts.
Artie, the guy's in first place. He's in first place. He's four games up on Girardi, the guy you love. And listen, it's not about being a technical genius. I'm not saying he hasn't made a share of mistakes. He has, but he's a young manager. He's still learning. And more importantly, they play for him. That's far more important in sports than the X's and O's. Is that at some point it may show up and you're going to make a mistake that could cost your team a championship. Yeah, that's happened before. Sure. No question about it. But nobody's perfect. And frankly, the guy's learning on the job. He had many of these players in the minor leagues. He sort of grew up with them and they play for him. Don't you understand? By the way, he's four games ahead of the guy you're talking about, Joe Girardi. You broke up there a little bit. I think you were talking about him, that you wanted him. And he's doing a good job. And granted, a middling division, the NL East right now, his temperament works with this group. They like him. They connect with him. He's going to make his mistakes with the bullpen and other areas and components of the team and organization as he learns. But some of the great coaches and managers in sports were not the best technicians. They got their players to play every single night. And listen, over 162 games, it's hard to play for a guy you don't like, okay, for 6 months plus the spring training and the postseason. You're talking about 8-9 months. It's different in football where you got to lay it on the line, 16 regular season games plus playoffs, and football is just an entirely different sport that can be ruled and managed and coached an entirely different way than baseball, where it's a grind over 7-8 months. If you're in the postseason, and I just think that there's something there with Rojas that reminds me a little bit of the way Joe Torre connected with people and players. There were players on that Yankee team that I interviewed over the years in the 90s when they were winning championships for him, who said, "We didn't want to disappoint Joe Torre because it felt like disappointing my father." That's a powerful sentiment. Now, Rojas is a lot younger, and they're not going to feel that way about him. He's not a fatherly presence. He might be a brotherly presence. But you got to look at the way his team plays, the injuries they've overcome, where they are right now. Do they look like a team that every day wants to play baseball and wants to play for that guy? And I think the answer is yes, they do. And when that changes, then we'll talk about making a change in the manager's position. But he's a guy that you have to say, despite his flaws, is doing a very good job.
You're listening to Anita Marks on 98.7 ESPN.